We sleep better when we sleep cool. As the weather is getting warmer, staying cool while we sleep will be top of mind. Organic and natural bedding sleeps cooler than cheaper synthetic alternatives, and they last longer too. A fresh season calls for a fresh start, and that includes your bed. From seriously soft organic cotton sheets to breathable silk and luxurious down duvets, Avocado Green's bedding makes it easy to reset your space sustainably. Perfect for hot sleepers in warmer months, Avocado Green sheets and duvet inserts are naturally breathable and help regulate temperature, so you sleep cool, dry, and comfortable all night long. Avocado bedding is thoughtfully designed and expertly crafted for lasting durability. From reinforced stitching to premium long staple organic fibers, every detail is made to stand the test of time, wash after wash, season after season. We sleep better when we sleep cool, so head to avocadomattress.com today to save 10% on all bedding and 50% on clearance bedding. Avocado, dream of better. Remember when I talked about True Diagnostics True Age Test? Well, I took it myself and the results blew my mind. I was very wrong. If you remember, I was worried about my brain and not my cardiovascular health. And it turns out my brain's fine, but my cardiovascular health needs work. But luckily, my biological age was really right on track with my actual age, which is good because research shows that if your biological age is even just 5 years older than your actual age, your risk of developing diseases like cancer or heart disease can jump by as much as 30 to 50%. That's a big deal, and it's completely avoidable. The good news is nearly 90% of biological aging is in your hands. It's driven by things like your lifestyle, your habits, and the environment you're in, which means that you have a lot of control over it. The True Age test didn't just give me a number. It showed how quickly my heart, brain, liver, and immune system are aging, and it was eye-opening. And I will say, I definitely picked up the workouts after I learned that my cardiovascular health isn't as good as I thought it was. The test itself was super easy and convenient. I did it from home, and it was just a quick, painless finger prick that I made Ethan do because I was too scared. You send it off in a tiny sample in a prepaid package, and in about 2 to 3 weeks, you'll get a detailed online report about your aging and health. So if you care about protecting your health and want to find out what your real age is, head over to truediagnostic.com and use my code ATTWG to get 20% off your entire order or subscription. That's truediagnostic.com and use ATTWG at checkout to get 20% off. Your future self will thank you. Are you ready to lose weight? With Effecty, getting access to powerful GLP-1 weight loss medications has never been easier or more affordable. Effecty offers compounded semaglutide, the same active ingredient as the popular name brands, but for up to 80% less. These medications work by regulating appetite and blood sugar, helping you lose weight in a sustainable, science-backed way. Getting started is so simple. Just fill out a short medical questionnaire, then connect with a licensed provider through a quick chat-based telehealth consultation. If you're eligible, your prescription gets shipped straight to your door. No hassle, no waiting rooms. With transparent pricing, no hidden fees, and no membership required, Effecty is committed to making proven weight loss treatments accessible to everyone. Effecty gave me the opportunity to try their service out, and I have to say, it is just as easy as they say it is. I filled out the questionnaire, and within days, a package arrived at my door filled with everything I needed and detailed instructions. Their website also tells you everything you need to know, and you can always chat with your healthcare provider. It really is that simple and convenient. So if you're ready to level up your weight loss game, my listeners can now get $50 off of GLP-1 weight loss treatments at Effecty.com with code ATTWG at checkout. That's Effecty.com, EFFECTY.com, and use the code ATTWG to get $50 off your first month of GLP-1 weight loss treatment. No hassles, no memberships, and no hidden fees. So get started today.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
In November of 2019, Oakley Carlson was just a month shy of her third birthday. But instead of celebrating it with the family who had been taking care of her since she was 7 months old, she was instead being returned to her biological parents. Oakley's foster parents, who had wanted to adopt the little girl whom they thought of as their daughter, begged the Washington State Department of Children, Youth, and Families to reconsider their decision because they did not believe that Oakley would be safe. 2 years later, their worst nightmare came true. Oakley was reported missing, and no one had seen her for nearly a year. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Oakley Carlson. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome.
Thank you for joining us once again. I've been following Oakley's case since she was reported missing in December of 2021. And I've held off doing an episode, though, because I was just hoping that it would have been resolved one way or another by now. Unfortunately, as of this recording, it's April 2022, and little Oakley Carlson remains missing, with no official sightings of her since February of 2021. This case is absolutely heart-wrenching and makes me think of Orrin and Orson West. It's almost like it's the exact opposite case. While those two children were taken away from their biological parents extremely quickly, with seemingly no chance at reunification, Oakley was given back to her biological parents extremely quickly. And unfortunately, both cases ended tragically. But before we get into this week's episode, we would like to thank Trina W., who has joined us over on Patreon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
If you would like to join us there, you can get these episodes early and ad-free, and maybe we can also get Ethan to write an episode of his flippin' show about mental health.
We'll see. Who knows?
But for now, let's get to the story of Oakley Carlson. Oakley Lynn Carlson was born on December 6th, 2016, to Jordan Bowers and Andrew Carlson. Oakley had two older siblings, a brother who was 9 at the time of her reported disappearance, who I believe may have a different father, and a sister who was 6 when Oakley was reported missing. The couple later had another child who was 2 when all of this was happening in December of 2021. So 4 children total. Andrew also has a daughter from a previous marriage, but it sounds like she lives with her mom and she's not, thankfully, like really not involved in this.
That's a lot of kids to keep track of.
Now, at first, everything seemed normal enough in the household. Like they seemed like a typical young married couple. But things seemed to start going downhill in 2017. As I mentioned in the intro, Oakley was taken away from her biological parents in August, and her older sister was also placed in foster care at that time. As for her brother, I'm not sure if he was put in foster care because I did read something about him having a different biological father, so he may have been placed with him. But in any case, Jordan and Andrew lost custody of their children in August of 2017. Now, when Oakley was born, Andrew Carlson was actually an Aberdeen, Washington police officer. And I'm not sure when he joined the force. I couldn't find that. But shortly before he and Jordan lost custody of their children, which was August of 2017, in February of 2017, he was actually fired for making false or misleading statements.
Yeah, that's not good.
And I feel like it's really hard to do. For most police agencies.
Yeah, I mean, especially for to get fired for that.
Yeah. Yeah, it said, so there's like a database online of officers who are, quote, like decommissioned is what they call it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he was on there and it happened.
Probably useful.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it happened in February 2017. And again, false or misleading statements, not that that's like great. But again, I feel like it's one, really hard for police officers to get fired. And two, for something like that, like it feels like that couldn't have been his first offense, you know?
When did he get hired on with them?
I don't know. I couldn't find that.
Because my thinking was that maybe he was still in a probationary period.
Oh, like you're right.
If it was at the beginning of his
career, it is a lot easier to get fired.
Yeah.
I mean,
with my job, if you're still within a year of being hired and you mess up in any way legally, you're out.
Yeah, and that very much could have been the case here. I really don't know. Unfortunately, I just could not find those records. So, that could be it.
Look, now, why it isn't just as easy 5 or 10 years down the line, I don't know.
It's a whole different podcast.
Yeah, but that's just my experience.
Yeah, so that was February 2017. August, they lose their kids. And then sometime in 2017, I don't know the date of the arrest, but Jordan was arrested for one count of identity theft in the first degree and 2 counts of identity theft in the second degree. And then her court date for that was February of 2018.
Okay. So this is obviously not necessarily building case, but showing that they're not the best.
Yeah. I mean, clearly they were having issues and, you know, at some point, probably leading up to this and during this, drugs were involved, specifically crystal meth.
Yeah. Really?
Mm-hmm. Now, during all of this, again, because, you know, like Jordan got arrested, she went to court in 2018. Like by this point, Oakley is already with her foster parents, Jamie Joe and Eric Hiles. Jamie Joe said that Oakley was a happy, kind, loving child who loved to read books. Like she was the type of kid who would fall asleep with a book in her bed. Her favorite bedtime story was I've Loved You Since Forever by Hoda Kotb. Jamie Jo told Fox 13 Seattle, quote, there are pictures of a mom and a baby on every page. We would read it and we would say, that's me and that's you. And so when you look through it, there's a baby bee and a mama bee. And at the very end was a lady holding a baby. And she always said, that's me and that's you, mama, end quote. The Hiles wanted to adopt Oakley. They didn't have other children and, you know, Jamie Joe said at one point that they felt like a regular nuclear family. They loved her. You know, they had her since she was 7 months old. But like most states, DCYFS in Washington always tries to reunite children with their biological parents.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for every state, obviously.
Right.
And even within the state, that gets broken down by typically by counties or cities or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
My experience that was the same way was the ultimate goal is reunification with the family.
Yeah.
But there are obviously, you know, obstacles that the biological parents have to go through in order to basically prove that they're ready for reunification.
Right. And of course, being foster parents, the Hiles were aware of this. You know, they knew that
that's the ultimate goal.
Exactly.
At least of the organization.
Right.
Now, you know, CYF, CYS, they are not the ones that are making the ultimate decision. That's family court. It goes before a judge who hears child advocates, lawyers for the parents. Here's from CYF, and they gather all of the information and make what they determine to be the best course of action for the child.
Yeah, and so from Jamie Joe's perspective, you know, she knew about all of this, but it doesn't sound like she was, like, super concerned about it because from her perspective, it didn't really seem like Jordan and Andrew were jumping through the necessary hoops and really kind of working on themselves.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
Because during all of this, like, they did have visitation with Oakley. You know, they were around and Oakley, you know. So, again, they did have contact. She was aware to some extent of, you know, what they were up to. And it didn't sound like she was really thinking that reunification was going to be happening anytime soon, if at all. So she was shocked, as was her husband, when in October of 2019, their caseworker told them that Oakley would be returning to her biological parents immediately. At that point, Oakley had never even had an overnight visit with them.
That kind of makes me uncomfortable. It makes me wonder what was going on in the case on their side and what the judge was seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, like you said, like this, I mean, she doesn't know her parents, her biological parents.
Right.
So, I mean,
she like knows them, but not as her kind parents. Of,
yeah. But like, exactly. Like that.
She considered Jamie, Joe, and Eric to be mom and dad.
Do you think that, I mean, I understand that obviously they're looking at the case as a whole and there's multiple kids.
Yeah.
But like, is that the best decision for each individual child?
Yeah. Well, the Hiles definitely didn't think that it was the right decision for Oakley. And at the very least, Jamie Joe thought that it was happening way too fast because, again, like Oakley had never had an overnight visit and they were saying, oh, yeah, she's just going to go live with them. That did not sit right with her at all. And so she begged the caseworker to rethink the decision or to at least slow the process down so that they can have more of a transition period.
Yeah. That individual caseworker, though, probably didn't have much of a say in it.
Right. But I mean, that was, you know, that was her point of contact. So.
Sure. Yeah. No, I understand that. Yeah. I understand that approach.
Well, but to that point, too, you know, I think that Jamie Joe did know that because, again, she's been a foster parent. Like, she kind of knows how the system works. So she also wrote letters to DCYFS and Oakley's daycare provider at the time also wrote letters, like basically because everyone in this little girl's life was extremely worried about this decision. But despite their pleas, the Hiles family lost Oakley just a month later in November of 2019, and they were never able to have contact with her again.
That's got to be really tough. I mean, not obviously just for the parents, but for Oakley. I mean,
yeah.
You said she was almost three.
Yeah, it was right before her third birthday.
And like, that's the point where things start to become routine.
Yeah.
Where life really becomes where you are.
Right. Like,
that makes
Oakley,
sense.
Well, yeah. And like, Oakley was in dance classes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, they had a family life. This wasn't a temporary placement. This is the only life that this little girl knew. This was mom and dad.
Yeah, and that's tough. And I, you know, again, obviously the ultimate goal is reunification with the parents, but it's harder with younger kids.
Yeah, when they don't know the parents.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, Jamie Joe said she had never cried harder in her entire life. She later told reporters, quote, loading her into that car 2 years ago felt like a death to us, end quote. So at this same time, you know, the other children also went back to the house. And not much is known about the early days and months of these children being back in the Carlson Bowers household. According to Eric Hiles, DCYFS caseworkers were only required to check in on the family for 6 months. He told KOMO News, quote, 6 months. They said they were going to check for 6 months, and that is not enough time. We had her for well over 2 years. In 6 months, they were able to check a couple of boxes, and they were okay. And 6 months were done, and they never checked her again, end quote.
Well, yeah, and it's probably only once a month during those 6 months.
Right.
Yeah, it's not just like they're popping in every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's tough. It's tough because, you know, I feel bad for the caseworker that was involved with this
mm-hmm.
because again, ultimate goal is reunification, right? But the reality is that, you know, you as a caseworker, and you know, your supervisor comes up with these plans for the parents to get to a certain point where they're considered fit to have their kids back, but that's the base level,
right?
You know, and that's the base level for all the kids. Doesn't matter. So it's tough to be the caseworker that is there for all of that, you know. And again, I would put more judgment on the judge who was overseeing this,
mm-hmm.
the reunification. Because it shouldn't be a blanket across the board for kids. Kids are at different ages, they're at different development stages in their lives, and
their placements are different too.
Yes,
you know,
right?
I mean, because one kid,
well, said the oldest one is with his biological father.
From what I understand, I don't have that confirmed, but okay. I believe so. Yes.
Yeah, which, you know, again, so that's why, you know, he didn't end up in foster care, because, at least from what research you have, is the easiest thing when you're removing kids from a bad situation is to find a biological relative that can take care of them.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that was what we did. But obviously that's far less disruptive to them,
mm-hmm.
than being placed in foster care.
Well, yeah. And like when the son came back, if he was with his biological father, Jordan and Andrew didn't regain custody, and then he was never allowed to see his biological father again. You know,
right. Yeah.
It wasn't that disruptive.
Right. But these foster parents don't have any rights.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they never had any contact after November of 2019. So yeah, so November 2019, she goes back with her biological parents. The caseworker comes for the next 6 months, checks in on them. Don't know specifically, of course, what they found or whatever, but nothing that was bad enough, you know,
for another removal.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But after that, you know, for the last half of 2020, we don't really know. You know, interestingly, I would also be curious, because that 6 months, that was the beginning. I mean, 3 of those months was the beginning of the COVID pandemic. So I'm wondering, actually, if it was even once a month visits, or if it was fewer visits.
Yeah, or if they were doing
it
Zoom
at all. Yeah, right?
Visits or whatever.
Yeah, so we really don't know how much she was getting checked on in the first 6 months.
No, I don't. I mean, none of that existed when I was a caseworker.
Well, exactly.
And obviously the pandemic wasn't there, so I can't even imagine what they had to go through.
So the 6 months go by, it's still 2020, you know. Yeah, we don't have a vaccine yet.
Right.
Like,
we weren't out of the woods yet.
Exactly. And so a lot of kids were not back in school and things like that. And so I think this time period, it was really easy for people to fall through the cracks. You know, it wasn't odd if you didn't see somebody for a long period of time.
And obviously we don't know this, but I mean, maybe the caseworker did go out and see the children, but you know, keep in mind that the time frame, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, mm-hmm. everybody was doing things outdoors.
Yeah.
So maybe the caseworker was able to again, quote unquote, I hate to say it, but check the box of seeing the children, but it
maybe,
was outside.
Oh, and they didn't even like so really go into the home, is what you're saying?
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, remember that's the way it was at the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah. I would be really curious if there are any, you know, caseworkers or anybody who listens to this, like who was working in 2020. I'm really curious whether you're in Washington State or not, just in general,
just
how
in
you
general.
Guys were handling that.
Yeah.
You know, at the beginning of the pandemic. Because part
of what they have to do, obviously, is not just to check on the children, but obviously check
the living situation. Yeah.
But if again, beginning of the pandemic, what we were all doing, you know, nobody was going into anybody's houses.
Right.
Nobody was going into restaurants.
Yeah.
So I wonder if they like said, hey, I'll come by the house, bring all the kids out so that I can see them and talk to them. But nobody was able to actually physically go into the house.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. So, you know, whether it's because of COVID or not, the next solid date we have in this story is over a year after Oakley was returned to her biological parents. So Christmas of 2020. The family went over to the grandparents' home for the holiday. Now, I do believe that this is Mr. and Mrs. Carlson, Andrew's parents, because from what I've read, it seems as though Jordan has become estranged from her parents in recent years. So the family goes over there, and according to the grandmother, Oakley did not look well. She had dark circles under her eyes, she was pale, and had either scratches or sores on her face.
That's not good.
No. And keep in mind, this is December of 2020. So, you know, pandemic or not, this is 6 months after, you know, those checks would have ended.
Sores on her face?
Or scratches.
Yeah, it fills me with a ton of questions about her living situation, which obviously we don't have that information. But drug addicts, regardless of what they're on, typically don't live in the most hygienic houses.
Mm-hmm.
So you say scratches on her face. I wonder, rodent infestation or possibly sores on her face. That leads down a whole other rabbit hole of what could be happening in that house.
The entire thing, you know, how Oakley looked, and I'm guessing just like the whole vibe of the visit, bothered the grandmother so much that she called CPS afterwards.
Good.
So later, though, after Oakley went missing and then she was interviewed by police, she, of course, told them about this whole Christmas thing and how she called CPS, but she said that CPS never followed up with her.
That's pretty shocking.
But even though CPS never followed up with her and presumably nothing really happened, it caused a huge problem between her and her son.
For sure.
And so Jordan and Andrew stopped speaking to them and refused to let them, you know, see the kids, just kind of cut them out of their life completely.
That's a tough balancing act, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? I mean, this is her son.
Yeah.
And her granddaughter, amongst other grandchildren,
yeah.
So it's really tough. I mean, do you report it, knowing that this could be the fallout, and then suddenly you don't have contact with the kids, so now there's nobody watching over the kids?
Yeah.
Or do you not report it so that you have more contact with the kids? It kind of blows my mind that there was no follow up, though.
Yeah, and that pattern does continue as we go into this. While I was researching this, everything that I read that had comments, whether it was like Facebook posts or web sleuth forums, you know, whatever it was, people kept on asking over and over, where were the grandparents in all this? Like, where were the grandparents? And this is what happened. Again, you know, well before any of these events took place, Jordan was already estranged from her parents. So the grandparents on that side already weren't involved. And then this happened with Andrew's parents in December of 2020. So they were estranged. And so they didn't know what was going on in the house either. So they didn't know what was or wasn't happening with Oakley or any of the other kids for that matter.
So you said there were other reports to CPS?
Yeah, so I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
A month and a half after this, on February 10th, 2021, Oakley was seen by someone outside of her immediate family. Now, police won't say who this was, but they are confident that Oakley Carlson was alive on that date. But that is the last confirmed sighting of the little girl who had just turned 4.
And in that sighting, do we have any update as far as how she looked, her well-being?
Police haven't released any of that. So when she was first reported missing in December of 2021, police originally had the date that she was last seen, I believe January 27th of 2021. So that was the date they were originally giving, and they didn't give a lot of information about that date, but then I guess they got information after that, after the investigation began. And so they amended that date to February 10th, 2021.
Right, but they're not releasing
any details, like who the person was who saw her, okay. Nothing. By the beginning of 2021, Jordan and Andrew had isolated themselves from their families. Oakley's older siblings were in school, but I don't believe Oakley was in kindergarten yet because, again, she was only four at the time. She was apparently in some transitional pre-K type program, but it doesn't sound like it was as official as regular K through 12 public school. So when she stopped showing up, you know, the normal alarm bells that you would think would go off when a kid stops showing up for school, like, didn't really go off.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like, I mean, you know, we just had our youngest out of pre-K for a couple of days because he went to the hospital, and they seemed pretty alarmed.
Well, yeah, they were, but again,
but I guess there was no reporting.
Yeah, there wasn't a report or anything like that. And, you know, I emailed them. There was like one day where I forgot to email them, but they generally knew what was going on.
Right.
All right. Keep in mind, so before we moved here, he was in daycare, and he was in daycare when COVID hit, and we took him out.
Oh, that's true.
Because they closed, and we went, even when they reopened, we kept him out of daycare because we were uncomfortable. And eventually they just assumed he was never coming back. And we moved, and so, like, he wasn't coming back, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
they never
reached out
or, like, that's worried.
Fair. That's fair. And even though they're, you know, I say this all the time, even though they're mandatory reporters, that's not necessarily a sign of negligence of them not being there because they're not mandated to be there.
Exactly. Again, school. This isn't K through 12.
Right.
Like, this is more of, like, an optional program.
Yeah.
So what happened in this case is just eventually the bus stopped coming for her. And so it doesn't seem like anyone was really wondering about Oakley except for the Hileses, who weren't permitted to have contact with her until November of 2021. Now, this is where the story gets crazy. And I feel like I say that in a lot of episodes, but we tell a lot of stories where things get crazy. And on November 6th, 2021, Andrew called dispatch. And so that's what the articles say, is that he called dispatch. Not that he called 911, not that he called, like, the non-emergency police number. They say that he called dispatch.
What the hell does that mean?
I don't know exactly. So I don't know if he called the fire department or if he called, like I said, the police non-emergency line or, like, who he called. But he called just after 5 p.m. to report a fire. But again, like I said, it was not a 911 call. He wasn't calling to report a fire in progress. He was calling to say that his house had caught fire earlier in the day.
Okay.
Yes. So according to him, Oakley had been playing with a lighter and had set the couch on fire.
All right.
Andrew and Jordan couldn't call 911 because they couldn't find their phones due to all of the smoke.
Uh-huh. So what they were just so busy battling the blaze and the smoke filled the house that they just couldn't possibly think to call 911.
Correct. According to them, they battled the fire themselves for about 4 hours.
Okay. I mean, do they live in an isolated area? Are there neighbors so far away that they wouldn't be able to, like? Okay, I'm forgoing I'm going with the reality of today's time where there is no landline in the house. Right. So there's only cell phones.
Yeah. So we've got to assume there's no landline.
Sure. And that's fine.
Yeah.
But they couldn't find their phones because of smoke in the house. So they spent 4 hours battling this blaze on their own as opposed to, like, going to a neighbor's to call 911.
Yeah. And so from what it sounded like, it did sound like they were in a rural area where there weren't neighbors around. And we'll talk about their house a little bit later, it is on 300 acres. However, there are also reports that we get into later from the neighbors that make it sound like there were people close by. So I don't know.
I mean, even if their neighbors aren't that close by, four hours.
Right? It seems like...
I mean, you could drive like 300 miles in 4 hours. Just a thought.
Yeah.
I'm just throwing it out there.
Like, yeah, or at least like one of you...
Get your family out of the house.
Right. So they... Yeah, exactly. Or like, yeah, one parent gets the kids, gets in the car, yeah. goes somewhere. The other parent stays and fights the fire for 4 hours. Maybe.
With a garden hose.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it was inside. So like, how do you get the garden hose?
Through a window?
I mean, sure, but I don't know.
Just pots of water from the sink.
Right. That's why it took 4 hours, because you got to wait till they fill up and then you're pouring it and then, you know.
I don't mean to make light of this.
No, just, but.
That is the most absurd fucking story I have ever heard in my life. I couldn't get to my phone for 4 hours because I was battling this couch fire
right.
in my house. So I couldn't possibly call 911.
Yeah. So it was like five.
Never. I mean, regardless, how old's the oldest kid?
Nine.
Hey, why don't you go call 911? I mean, come on.
Yeah. Like go run to the neighbor's house.
Yes.
Yeah. So he does finally call it in at like 5 o'clock. And says, hey, like, this is taken care of. Like, we're cool. We don't need assistance. I just wanted to, you know, let y'all know.
Why?
From my perspective, I mean, if you're looking at this completely just with no skepticism whatsoever, I would say for insurance purposes, you've got to have a report.
Sure.
So right after this, a friend of theirs set up a GoFundMe for the family because, you know, their house was damaged by a fire.
Was it a GoFundMe for them to get a phone in their house?
I mean, I don't know. So like, unfortunately, it's been taken down. So I couldn't read the full text. I've just been able to get snippets from people who had seen it. But it did allegedly say that, quote, all three of their children made it out of the fire. Yeah. Because if you're including Oakley, they had four.
Okay.
But this was made by a friend. So this was not, presumably, this was not written by the parents.
Okay. So we'll give benefit of the doubt that the friend fucked up.
Or that the friend only knew there to be three children in the house.
I guess it depends on how dark you want to go.
And the friend knew that everybody made it out of the house that day. Who was there? So this fire, which of course people have many theories about, is really when everything started to fall apart for Jordan and Andrew. So the thing about a fire, especially when there are children involved who, you know, apparently got out safely, like it's still a very scary thing. And there's a GoFundMe. So like clearly this is becoming a big deal, right? So on November 10th, 4 days after the fire, Jessica Swift, the principal of Oakville Elementary School, which Oakley's older siblings attended, came to the home to drop off, you know, supplies or just clothes, like who knows, you know, just. They needed stuff, just right?
Trying to help out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, while she was there, she saw the other three children, but not Oakley. So she asked Jordan and Andrew where Oakley was, and they said that she was in her room.
Okay.
So again, you know, whatever, fine. Like, she dropped off the stuff. She left, didn't think a whole lot of it. She
but
came.
The kids said that.
No. The parents said it.
Okay.
Yeah. So during this time, and because she used the principal of the school where two of the children went, you know, she was like very involved and like was in contact with the parents constantly and, you know, just how are you doing? What can we do to help? That kind of stuff. She went back to the home a few weeks later on November 24th to drop off some more supplies. And this was right before Thanksgiving. So it was probably one of those like, oh, here's a turkey, like, you know, type of things too. This time, she was only there for about 5 minutes or so. So once again, she didn't see Oakley, but it didn't strike her as super weird because she was there for such a short period of time.
Sure.
But on December 4th, 2021, that all changed. On that day, Oakley's older sister was invited over to Jessica's home to celebrate her daughter's birthday. So it just so happened that Oakley's older sister was the same age as the principal's daughter, and they were friends. So it's the principal's daughter's birthday, and they had like a party play date thing, and it was followed by a sleepover. So while Oakley's older sister was over there, and by the way, I'm not using any of the names of any of the siblings because they're children, and you know, we try not to do that unless they're the one who's actually missing and you need to know their name.
Right.
While Oakley's older sister was over at Jessica's house, you know, Jessica was just talking to her, just like normal chit chat, and kind of asking her how Oakley was doing after everything that happened. Because apparently Jessica was one of the people to whom Jordan had told the story about Oakley setting the fire. Mm. So she was probably worried about like how this like little girl was handling everything.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
According to an interview that Jessica later gave to police, when she asked the little girl about Oakley, she became very quiet and then got upset. She then said, quote, "Oakley is no more," end quote.
And the truth comes out. And that's why I was wondering before if the principal had spoken to any of the kids versus the adults.
Right.
Because the kids aren't going to cover up something like this.
Yeah, or at least not well.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Oakley is no more.
Yeah, and so Jessica asked her what she meant by that. She said that Oakley had gone back to live with her foster parents. And as we now know, that was unfortunately not the case. So Jessica was obviously very concerned about this conversation. And so, you know, it was a sleepover, like I said. So she kind of let it go for the evening. And of course, I'm sure was just stewing over it all night. And then the next day, she kind of broached the subject with her again. She asked if Oakley lived with them, and the little girl said no. She then said again that Oakley had gone back to her foster parents. But that is not at all what Jordan and Andrew had been telling Jessica. Because again, remember, she had been in constant contact with them since this fire. They said that Oakley was there. She started the fire. She lit this couch on fire. Like, she was living in the house. She was in her bedroom the first time Jessica came over to drop supplies off. So these stories are very far apart. So Jessica's an elementary school principal. So not only does she have spidey senses when it comes to things like this, but she's a mandatory reporter.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that day, December 5th, she called the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Department and requested a welfare check. By this time, Jordan and Andrew had moved with their three children out of the damaged home in Oakville, Washington, and they were staying at a hotel in nearby Tumwater, Washington. And just as an interesting aside, Tumwater is where Logan Schindelman, who we covered in season 2, was from. So this is the second time we've ended up in Tumwater, Washington, which is like a very tiny, tiny town.
What the hell?
Yeah. So on December 6th, the Tumwater Police Department went to the hotel where they were staying to perform the welfare check. And this is what baffles me, because going back quickly to the Orrin and Orson case, those parents concocted a story, right? It was a dumb story that didn't make any sense, but they like spent time, concocted a story, like really tried to sell it. Jordan and Andrew apparently did not bother to do that. So when responding officers came to do the welfare check and saw that Oakley was not there, they asked Jordan where she was, and she said that she was with her mom. And then she kind of like, so all this is happening kind of like in the doorway of the motel room or whatever.
She was with Jordan's mom.
Right.
Okay. Who's been estranged. Well, nobody would know that.
Yeah, they don't know that. So she's like, oh yeah, she's with my mom. But then, so this is all in the doorway. And then she kind of like, you know, turns her head, and she's got the 2-year-old in her arm at this point. She kind of turns her head and yells back into the room, you know, presumably to Andrew, like, oh, she's with your mom and dad, right? So then police talk to them separately. And Andrew said that Oakley was at his father's house.
Okay.
Yeah, which, like, fine. At her grandpa's house, no big deal. So officers are like, okay, what's your father's contact information?
Right. This is a welfare check on the children, so
yeah,
we need to do a welfare check on the children.
Right.
All of them.
Exactly. So if she's not here, we need to go to where she is. So then Andrew said, well, I don't remember his phone number. Also, I don't remember his address.
Those aren't my pants.
I mean, I don't remember my dad's address, yeah, but my daughter's there.
Right?
Like, you couldn't come up with anything better in all of this time.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. This dude used to be a cop, even if for a little while. Like, dear Lord. So police eventually figured out where Andrew's father lived and got in contact with him. And he was like, yeah, I haven't seen Oakley in almost a year, you know, since Christmas of 2020. So then officers go back and they're like, hey, so, you know, your dad said he hasn't seen Oakley. She's definitely not there. And apparently Andrew was, you know, not surprised by this information, was acting very like nonchalant about it. Like, yeah, And so then they confronted Jordan about it, and Jordan's reaction was different. She just got very angry, and according to the police report, she was like clenching her fists and started yelling and said, I'm not answering any more of your questions, and just went back into the hotel room.
Okay.
So then when officers left, and this is what the article said again, and I don't know what it means, but it said Andrew reportedly called dispatch.
Whoa.
Okay.
When officers left?
Yes.
They hadn't completed the welfare check. They have not seen Oakley.
Correct.
So they got spun around, said she's with all of these different people. Then they contact his dad, grandpa. Grandpa says, I haven't seen her for a year. Goes back and says, and mom gets pissed off and slams the door in their face or
yeah,
whatever. And they're just like, eh, well.
Okay. So it's actually not that bad.
Okay. Because that's the way you painted it. And,
I know.
I was so about to freak the fuck out.
No, it's not quite that bad. So what it sounds like is they left like the room, but they didn't leave the premises.
Okay. All right. That's fine. That's fair.
Yeah. So they left the room and it sounds like they just kind of sat in the parking lot, you know, whatever, like at the hotel.
Yeah, probably trying to figure out what the fuck to do from there. That's fine, them leaving the room. Clearly, Oakley isn't in the room.
Well, exactly. So, like, what are they going to do? So they leave the room. Andrew then calls dispatch again, whatever that means.
Yeah.
And reports Oakley missing. He's just like, oh, by the way, don't know where my daughter is.
While the police are just like sitting outside of the
hotel. I don't know if he knew that they were still there or not. Like, I have no idea. But yeah, so he did that. And then it was later found out that within 10 minutes of the police leaving, he reset his cell phone to factory settings.
All right.
So then they apparently called the elementary school and said that they were going to pick up their daughter due to a family emergency. So, yeah, Oakley's older sister, the one who was at the sleepover.
Right.
So, of course, Jessica Swift, the principal who, you know, started this whole ball rolling, was like, oh, shit, like, this doesn't sound good. Like, what am I supposed to do? So she called the cops and let them know. And they're like, no. Like, do not.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, good.
They're like, do not release her. Keep her in school.
So this is a good response from the cops.
It actually seems like it's pretty good.
This is good.
Yeah.
You were taking me down a rabbit hole I thought it was going to be bad cops here, but like they're actually on it. It seems like.
Yeah. It seems like they're doing like, okay, at this point. It ended up not mattering because Jordan and Andrew didn't like head from the hotel to the school. Instead, they headed from the hotel back to their house. So police followed them there. They either followed them there from the hotel or there are already officers there or both. I'm not entirely sure. But one way or another, police were like waiting for them. And once the couple got back to the house, they were arrested for obstructing the investigation.
Fan-fucking-tastic.
Yeah. So I don't know if the plan was to go home and either get some more things or like try to hide
some
evidence.
Some more evidence, yeah.
And then get their daughter and then split.
That, or what? That would be my guess.
Yeah, exactly. But luckily, they didn't go to the school first. So, you know, that ended up being a non-issue. They went to the home. They were arrested. So once they were arrested, the police were there. They were able to get a search warrant for the home. When they executed the search, they found several disturbing things. Now, the first thing they noticed was that there were bedrooms set up with clothes and toys for Oakley's siblings, but not for her. More disturbingly, they also found what was initially described as blood on the blinds and the front door, but in more recent articles was described as blood spatter and a handprint on the wall on the downstairs hallway.
Can't imagine that the measurements of said handprint were released.
No. No more details beyond that.
Okay.
During this, a fire investigator also came to the home and...
Released from dispatch?
Yeah, I guess. And said that the fire actually appeared to have started in the microwave in the kitchen, not the couch in the living room, as Jordan and Andrew had claimed. And we actually do have... I was able to find a photo of the kitchen that showed the fridge and the microwave, but I wasn't able to find any other photos of the home. So we do have that. We'll have that on our blog. So at this time, you know, everybody was brought in for questioning. I shouldn't say at this time. So I know, you know, Jordan and Andrew were brought in for questioning immediately, obviously, because they were under arrest. And then the siblings were also questioned around this time. Jordan still wasn't cooperating at all. She wasn't answering questions. Just nothing from her. Andrew, according to police reports, was just like making really disturbing statements along the lines of like, Oakley won't be coming home for a reunion.
What the fuck does that mean?
I don't know.
He's making those statements to law enforcement?
Yeah, it's in the police report. And like the way that it's written, it sounded like they were kind of creeped out by him. So like I said, both parents had been arrested, you know, initially for obstructing the investigation. But after that arrest, while they were in custody, they were also arrested on suspicion of first-degree manslaughter. When officers interviewed Oakley's older siblings, they made many more disturbing statements. Oakley's sister first told police that she didn't have a sister. Then she said that Oakley was her sister, but not anymore. According to the detective's report, she said, quote, her mother, Jordan, told her not to talk about Oakley and that she had gone out to be eaten by wolves, end quote. When asked if Oakley had been hurt, she started to cry. Oakley's older brother was also interviewed and told police that his mother beat Oakley with a belt and would, quote, put Oakley in the closet, possibly under a stairwell, end quote, according to the police report. He also said that he had been worried about her starving. So apparently this whole like suspicion of manslaughter thing was only a 72-hour hold. I don't know exactly how that works, but it sounds like they arrested him for that basically to make sure that they would have them in custody for 72 hours, as opposed to the obstruction charge, which I'm guessing is a much lesser charge, and they probably could have gotten bailed out pretty quickly.
I mean, yeah, I don't know the specifics of the county, but
exactly. So it's so hard because laws vary so much, you know, between
really
jurisdictions. And I've never heard of like this 72-hour hold, but again, that's what it was. And so police basically had like 72 guaranteed hours of this couple in custody and they used it. I mean, they really like immediately went hard and tried to investigate everything, not just Oakley's disappearance, but like what the hell was going on in that house,
right?
In general. So by the time those 72 hours were up and they would presumably have had to release them, they had found something else to charge them with: abandonment of a dependent person in the second degree. But surprisingly, this charge wasn't related to Oakley at all. It was related to her older sister.
Oh?
Oakley's sister is medically fragile, and she was born undersized. And she was actually very early on diagnosed with failure to thrive. So she was on a lot of medications. She had lost sight in both of her eyes. And I read one thing that says she had lost full sight in both of her eyes. I'm not entirely sure about that, if it was full sight, partial sight, what it was. But she was also supposed to be on human growth hormones because, again, she was just so small and, like, she had the, like I said, the failure to thrive. And so that had been prescribed to her and was very important for her to take. But in the course of this investigation, police had found that her parents had not been giving her her medication for the past 15 months.
Jesus.
Yeah. And so while they did not physically abandon her, you know, apparently this charge kind of encompasses
I'm sure the neglect, basically. Yes, I'm sure the verbiage of the statute
encompasses
neglect of some sort.
So this charge, you know, ensured that they would kind of be in jail for a little bit longer. And eventually at one of their hearings, so this was a misdemeanor and it actually got kicked up to a Class C felony. So they were, like, basically just trying to, you know, investigate, keep them in jail, whatever. And this isn't actually one of those, because we've run into this situation in some cases where, like, charges get stacked and it's, like, really kind of shady. But this pretty legit.
It seems like they're driving to a specific goal.
Yeah.
Of finding out what the hell happened to Oakley.
Right. But even beyond that, they're clearly not taking care of their other children properly.
Yeah,
and so regardless of Oakley, like, this is a valid thing
that they should have been charged with, right?
You know?
Yeah, no, legit. They're not making up these charges.
Right.
Like, they're finding
evidence of other wrongdoing.
Right.
Basically.
Yeah. And then stacking those existing charges to further investigate.
Right. So as all of this is happening and these detectives are kind of, like, looking into this and dealing with the parents, police and the FBI, because the FBI came in, you know, very quickly after all this started, they were searching for Oakley. So they started with the family at home, which was apparently owned by one of Andrew's relatives. And this, like I mentioned before, presented some problems as it sat on about 300 acres. They brought out cadaver dogs and divers ended up searching a flooded area of the property. Within days, 7 different agencies were working on this case and assisting with the search. They were digging, you know, different places on the property. They were just looking everywhere. And of course, they were interviewing neighbors. And this is where, you know, again, going back to the fire, where it was confusing because some of the neighbors reported that they had called 911 several times after hearing what they called explosive fights between Jordan and Andrew. So if you're in a single family home on land, yet somehow your neighbors are hearing your fights. One, those must be some pretty bad fights. And two, they can't be that far away that you can't go to them if your friggin' house is on fire for 4 hours.
Right. Again, 4 hours, you can drive 300 miles.
Yeah. I don't know. Grace Harbor County Undersheriff Brad Johansson told KIRO 7 Seattle, quote, "If there's burn piles, we're going to go through the burn piles. If there's any fresh dirt, we're looking in fresh dirt. Any crawl spaces, enclosed spaces, we're checking everything we can possibly do," end quote. But by December 13th, no sign of Oakley was found except for that potential blood evidence in the home, which was being sent out for DNA testing. So, you know, they didn't find anything else outside of the home. So on December 13th, the search was called off.
So the original call was for a fire on the sofa,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Mm-hmm.
Do we have anything about that at all? Did they look through that?
Yeah. I mean, just that the investigator said that the fire started in the kitchen. I haven't read any, like, if they found any evidence of suspicious things being burned or it doesn't sound like there's any evidence of a body or anything like that. If that's what you're getting. Yeah.
That's where it was going.
I know. And that is one of the theories that people have regarding the fire, that Oakley actually died in the fire. The other theory is that they started the fire in order to cover up evidence. The third theory is that they were cooking meth and started a fire accidentally.
And the reality could be somewhere in between that, right?
So yeah.
Let's say you have somebody that's on meth who's been cooking. Look, kids take up a lot of attention, right?
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate thing is that if you are on stimulants like that, your attention span is very limited and you tend to get agitated a lot quicker than normal.
Mm-hmm.
So older kids have probably, unfortunately, learned to adapt and go away, right?
Yeah.
Little one, not so much. Younger kids require more attention. They're coming to the parents to get that attention. The parents are strung out. If we're assuming meth is what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I will say that later on, Andrew does admit that they had recently relapsed. So okay. Meth certainly was involved in some
capacity.
Yes.
Yeah. So given that situation, the unfortunate thing is the negative output from the parents would be directed specifically at Oakley, because the older kids basically can go and hide.
Right. And the younger one, you could presumably throw them in the crib or like a pack and play and kind of keep them somewhere.
Still not great.
Well, no, again, not great. But like it makes sense that, you know, that one was young enough that you could just put them somewhere.
Yes. This is a very dark road we're going down, but like legitimately,
it's a dark case.
I think that's what happened. I think Oakley was the kid that needed the most attention at the time, or that they couldn't ignore, and then something happened.
So by this point, we're talking, you know, December 13th, news of Oakley's disappearance had gotten out of, you know, into the community. It was a huge, huge local news story. And the entire community was just shocked and angry that this had happened. Of course, Stephanie Smith, the woman who ran the daycare that Oakley attended when she was with the Hiles family, and another woman started a change.org petition that called for more safeguards for children who are being reunited with parents after being placed in foster care. It reads in part, quote, "Like a 5-point safety harness of a car seat, there should be a law requiring a 5-point safety network for every foster child placed back into the home. This ensures if one point of safety fails, the child is still held safely by the others still intact," end quote. So basically what they're saying is that one agency doing checks for 6 months is simply not enough to prevent a tragedy like this from happening. We talked earlier about Oakley's grandma reaching out to CPS in December of 2020, but Jamie Jo Hiles, Oakley's foster mom, reached out to CPS after she had heard some disturbing news from a friend of the family in January of 2021. They never got back to her. She reached out again in November of 2021 after the fire, and once again, nobody ever got back to her. In addition to the 5-point safety check, the petition also proposes that parents continue to undergo drug screenings after reunification with their children. They want to call this Oakley's Law. By December 17th of 2021, the petition had garnered 7,000 signatures.
I would go a step further with mm-hmm. that. So love all of it. Absolutely, 100%. But from a caseworker's position, it needs to go further than just we get to the point where we close out the case.
Mm-hmm.
Because cases like this, and, you know, I hate to heap more work on social workers because, like, they're really overworked and extremely underpaid.
Right.
But this is what their role is in preventing something like this. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So there needs to be more longevity, even beyond what already exists with children in the system at all. I'll give you my, you know, an example from my experience, I was an intake investigator. So I was only supposed to have cases for 1 month before I transferred them to either quote unquote long term, which was family care, or unfounded, meaning that there was no other, there was no follow up.
The case was closed. Yeah.
But 23 years old, take all of that into consideration. I had no idea what the hell I was doing, but whatever. I only had the case for 1 month, and I was getting pressure to transfer or close.
Right.
Regardless of what I found.
Yeah. And regardless of whether or not you knew, you had a good handle on like what was happening.
I had no good hand. None of my cases I felt warm and fuzzy about.
Yeah.
You know, transferring them or closing them out one way or the other, I didn't feel happy about anything because I had only been involved with it for a month, you know, and it's not like it was like, I have one case for a month.
Right, right.
No, I had 30 plus cases in that month. So again, I hate to heap more work on social workers, but like a lot of these cases need more and more attention.
Well, and I think that's kind of what they're saying is that if you have five people instead of one person from different areas checking in on this child, then it doesn't put that huge burden on like the caseworker or whoever, right? Like, you know, it puts it, it shares it among whether it's a you know, the caseworker and then also a trusted family member and then also a school principal and then also a church member if they go to church, you know, like whatever it is. Like the point is that if you just share it among people and then you just have a larger, stronger safety net. And so if somebody misses something, maybe person number two won't, maybe person number three won't.
But if that's the case, who do they report to?
Well, I mean, I think they would eventually end up reporting back to like the caseworker, right? I just think it's just more of like just supporting the social worker, basically, because I think they recognize that one person, overworked person
does not have enough eyes on,
yeah,
like physically cannot be everywhere and see everything and incorporate everything.
Right. And you've got to think that the reason that they picked 6 months as the follow-up period wasn't because like studies show that after 6 months, everything's great. It's because of staffing. It's because of workload. It's because of like, we need this shit out of our...
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. You know, like that's what it is.
And judges are not immune to it. Family court is not immune to it because that 6 months was actually probably set by a judge because this, you're talking about a child removal or a child custody hearing. So a judge at some point needed to be involved. So they probably set it for the same reason because they wanted off their docket too.
Yeah. In January of 22, Andrew was back in court because again, you know, they'd both been in jail this whole time and he pleaded not guilty to that abandonment charge. But in February of this year, the couple was hit with more charges, 2 counts of endangerment with a controlled substance. Do you have an idea of what that could have been?
Could it be meth?
Yeah. So specifically, this came after two of their children, the 6-year-old and the 2-year-old, were given hair follicle drug tests where meth was found.
Right. Which means it was in the air around them, not necessarily in their systems.
Well, that's best case scenario because according to court documents, Oakley's siblings had extremely high levels of methamphetamines in their systems, suggesting that they had either been exposed to the drug or may have ingested it. Andrew pleaded guilty to these charges on March 14th, 2022. So now he actually had no criminal history at this point. He had been arrested for things before, but hadn't actually been convicted for anything. So he was sentenced to 12 months in prison at the end of March of 2022. And the second degree abandonment charge, you know, which stemmed from not giving his older daughter her medication, was dismissed. So at this point, he will be eligible for early release as soon as August of 2022, which is about 4 months from now, from this recording.
The time constraint on the investigation is getting tight. Yeah.
So that's where we are. Now, Jordan was being held on all of the same charges. So they were charged with the exact same thing. But she did not take the plea. She was allegedly offered the same plea that he was, but she was not interested. And she wasn't talking, just like not having any of it. So at Andrew's March 14th hearing, which is the hearing in which he ended up pleading guilty, a group of people, including Oakley's foster parents, held a rally outside of the courtroom where they were chanting things like, "Make her talk, make her talk," among other things. Jamie Jo said that she absolutely hoped that one or both of them would crack and say what happened to Oakley. In fact, Kevin Schrader, chief criminal deputy with the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office, said that Andrew would remain in jail to serve his sentence rather than prison so that detectives could have easy access to him.
Well, I got to say this, I feel like we're very negative on law enforcement.
Not always.
But specifically in this case, like, holy shit, kudos to them. It seems, at least from an outside perspective, from what you're telling me, like, they are really doing everything that they can.
Yeah, and when this story first broke and people are like, wait, how in the hell did this happen? How did nobody know where this little girl was? What is happening?
Yeah, but you get into the weeds of it and you understand why law enforcement wouldn't really be involved.
Well, exactly. Well, that was the thing. So very early on in one of the, like, the very first articles, there was somebody from the sheriff's department that was like, we just found out about this 2 days ago.
Yeah, right.
Like, we did not know.
Yeah, so they're trying to play catch up.
Exactly. They're and like, we were not involved in this.
Wasn't this like the, there's overlapping jurisdictions or
exactly.
different jurisdictions
yeah.
where the hotel or the motel was yep. where they were staying.
Yeah. And so it's Grays County Sheriff's Office and Tumwater Police.
Right.
Were
yeah.
the
so,
two main main agencies.
Yeah. And look, realistically, unless there's some reason why law enforcement would be called for child abuse or child neglect or anything like that, that would normally just have a CYS worker
yeah.
involved. Like, law enforcement isn't going to be there.
And from what I understand, you know, there were the calls, the police calls about the fights. And I don't know whatever happened, if police ended up going out there, whatever. But, like, to my knowledge, there was never, after the children were initially removed in 2017, there were never any calls related to the children, any calls to law enforcement.
To law
I mean.
Enforcement, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, law enforcement, like, they don't go to a house, even if they did go out because somebody called because of a loud fight, they don't go out with a full dossier of, like, this family's
exactly.
entire history. Like,
exactly.
they have no idea.
Right.
You know, they're just going out to respond to this specific call and that's it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so they didn't know about any of it at all. So, yeah, in terms of the people and organizations and institutions who failed Oakley along the way, in this case, like, I don't think we can really put the police on the list.
No.
Or Jessica, the principal, who's actually the hero of this entire story.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, honestly, I would want to know, again, you've got social workers. They are not the ones making the decision for removal, reunification. There's somebody above them doing it. And it's not even a supervisor at their agency. That's a judge. I'm sorry, but the fault lies with them.
Yeah. And so I think it is.
I don't want to say the fault because
well,
that's
no, because it's not their
no,
fault.
It's the fucking parents.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like,
but no, but I think this is important to not only look at that, but to look into Children, Youth, and Family Services and what their policies are. You've got to look at the whole picture, right?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
And I think this is bringing that up and making people more aware of the issues that are inherent in the system. And same thing with Orrin and Orson West in California, like, again, the opposite problem. Why was reunification not on the table? Like, right. Why were these children adopted so quickly? Why were the parental rights terminated so quickly? Why were these parents who, like, didn't even really have a job and were living in this tiny apartment given all of these children by the state, you know?
Yeah. Right.
Why, like, it's just both of these cases, you know, have very different failings in the system, but they are both serving to highlight the failings. And so, you know, maybe we can end up doing a little bit better. Maybe because right now, like in all the articles, of course, all the reporters are like, well, we reached out to Department of Family Services and they said privacy laws mean that we can't say anything, which, okay, sure. But also it's, you know, it's a very convenient shield for them to not have to answer for the ways in which they failed this little girl.
Right. And so there needs to be a larger investigation.
Exactly. And so talking about this and bringing this up and showing where these holes are can help facilitate that.
Hey, future electoral candidates there.
Yeah.
There's your platform.
Well, exactly. And there are legislators in Washington in the area who are getting involved. And again, who have been talking about, you know, the potential of Oakley's Law and things like that. So absolutely there is momentum. And, you know, back to the, you know, Orton Orson West, like there's a lawsuit against the county there. And, you know, so things like are certainly happening because of these cases.
Also, who the fuck has 300 acres of land?
His family.
Like,
yeah, not what, him.
What the hell?
Because I don't know what his job was like after he got fired from the police department.
Fucking cooking meth.
Apparently. I don't know.
I guess it's lucrative, but fuck, like.
Yeah, so some family member, you know, it honestly is probably his parents. I don't know, but like, they're like, hey, you can live here. And then he's cutting them off from his life. I don't know, you know, regardless. So that's where we are. So right now, Andrew is in jail serving a 12-month sentence. Jordan's trial, because again, she did not accept the same plea deal, was scheduled for April 19th, 2022. But just a few days before we are recording this, on Friday, April 8th, she took a plea deal, but not the same plea deal. She submitted an Alford plea in the two charges of child endangerment with a controlled substance. And for those of you who may be unfamiliar with the Alford plea, this is a plea in which you acknowledge that the state has enough evidence to convict, but you don't actually admit guilt. Jordan Bowers was sentenced to 15 to 20 months in jail for each charge. Her sentence was higher than Andrew's due to her previous criminal record. But basically, like you said, I mean, these sentences are buying time for investigators, and they're very valid. Like, again, their kids tested positive for meth. One of them was 2 years old. We don't know how that's going to affect him down the line. This is not good. They should absolutely have been charged with this regardless of anything that happened with Oakley.
However, I'm sure the DA and the investigators are all on the same page. Like, let's charge them with this. Let's get them in jail for this amount of time so that they can bolster a better investigation.
Exactly. And police are continuing to actively investigate Oakley's disappearance and build the case against her biological parents. So that is why it is so important for anyone who knows Jordan and or Andrew to come forward with any information they have about their actions, no matter how insignificant it may seem, between Oakley's last sighting in February of 2021 and their arrest in December of 2021. So if you were around these people, if you saw them, I mean, I don't even care if you're in line behind them at the grocery store, call the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Department. Let them know. Like, they need to get as much information as possible about their movements, about what was going on during this time, so that they can piece together a timeline and build a case. What happened to Oakley will have lasting effects on her siblings, her community, and the foster family who loved her. Jamie Jo Hiles told News Nation, quote, "I think about the abuse that happened, like hearing from the police reports about Oakley being starved, or that she was beaten with a belt, or that she was locked in a cabinet. That's the stuff I think about before I go to sleep. Because if Oakley would have stayed in my care, that never would have happened to her. Ever." End quote. Thank you. Oakley Carlson has been missing from Oakville, Washington since February 10th, 2021. She's a white female with brown hair and brown eyes. She was 3 feet tall at the time of her disappearance and weighed approximately 50 pounds. She was 4 years old when she went missing. She would be 5 today. Anyone with information on Oakley or her whereabouts is urged to call the Grays Harbor County Sheriff's Office at 360-533-8765 and ask to speak to a deputy, or call Detective Sergeant Paul Logan at 360-964-1729. You can also email sodetectives@co.grays-harbor.wa.us. Deputies ask that if you've seen her within the last year, to give them a call. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod, on Facebook and at @ATTWGPod on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Granger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRANGER, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Stop by Sherwin-Williams and get 30% off select paints and stains May 2nd through the 12th. It's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Refresh your home inside and out with colors that make every space feel brand new. From cozy interiors to stunning exteriors, we've got the perfect shade for your next project. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.